I'm Isaac DeVere, and welcome to Off Message, brought to you for this episode from just off the floor of the Democratic National Committee meeting here in Atlanta. I spent all of Saturday looking at the faces of DNC members as they realized they were going to have a 12-hour day in front of them, picking the new chair and then secretary and treasurer and all the way down now to the vice chairs as we get to the end of the night. Donna Brazile, the interim chair of the DNC, took over in the midst of all the hacking problems that led to the departure of Debbie Wasserman Schultz right in the middle of the Democratic convention last summer, has had a rough year and had a lot of things that she had to deal with as the DNC was suffering through a lot of dysfunction and obviously what was a very bad year for the Democratic Party. Donna hasn't talked much about any of that, but now, as she is officially no longer the interim chair of the Democratic Party, and Tom Perez has won election to replace her, she's ready to open up. I want to remind everybody to follow me on Twitter and on Facebook, at Isaac DeVere on Twitter. Pull me up on Facebook. Email me at isaac@politico.com. Let me know who you want to hear from next, who you're interested in, what the issues that you're interested in, and we will do our best to bring those people on. And now let's get to Donna Brazile. This was a hard year for you. Was it the hardest year of your life?
No. It's almost on par with Hurricane Katrina in many ways in terms of the level of stress, anxiety.
Were you 2016, in New Orleans when Katrina hit?
No, I was not. I was on the East Coast. It actually, 2016 felt good. I mean, after all, I was doing what I enjoyed best. I was traveling from state to state, following the unfolding of the 2016 presidential calendar, the primary calendar. I've had a hand in shaping the calendar now for 20 plus years, and so I was enjoying myself. And then I received that phone call.
Right.
But it wasn't the phone call that you might think it was. It was the phone call telling me that Seth Rich was murdered. That, in my judgment, turned everything around. All of a sudden, I went from, you know, somewhat of a predictable life, waking up, figuring out if I had a TV appearance, if I had, you know, a lecture, if I had to travel, you know, for some campaigns. But when Seth died, it really changed my life.
Did you work with Seth a lot?
Seth belonged to my department. I was the former vice chair for civic engagement and voter protection. And I have three staff people, and Seth was a member of my team. He was a great member of my team. He developed a lot of the technology that we began to use to help citizens register to vote and those citizens who were registered to find their polling place. So it really came as a complete shock. Seth was a patriot. He wanted to participate in electoral democracy. He had applied to even go up to Brooklyn to work on the Clinton campaign once the nomination was over. He was in a period of transition, and he was murdered in the midst of that.
And then, and that's right before everything happens with you taking over his chair.
Well, about 14 days later, after I visited the Republican convention, that was my, I believe, my fourth Republican convention. Started out.
And what number Democratic convention are we at?
Well, you know, I'm involved in so many conventions. I've been to every Democratic convention since 1984, and I attended the 2004, 2008. In 2012 and 2016 Republican convention as part of the political team for CNN and ABC.
Right. So what's the call when they, it's Donna, we need you to take over the Democratic National Committee?
Well, the first time I took over in 2011, it was a call from Tim Kaine telling me that he had decided to run for the United States Senate. And I said at the time, can you give me a few hours to make a phone call? The good news is that unlike September of 1999, when Al Gore asked me to be his campaign manager when I had to drop everything but teaching, my semester had already come to a close. So I did not have to drop teaching. When I received the call this time, I had to make some immediate decisions. And the first one, of course, was to suspend my contracts with not just CNN and ABC, but also I was a syndicated newspaper writer. I wrote for Essence Magazine, Men's Magazine, all the Oprah Magazine. I also suspended all of my business contracts and ties. I essentially had to strip my life down to the bare minimum. You know, I used
But that's what happens when Obama calls and says we need you
well,
to do
Well, whenever you get a phone call and you have five basic buckets, my bucket, my DNC bucket, I used to call it my empty bucket because while it was a fulfilling responsibility, it didn't pay.
Yeah.
And so I decided to step up without pay, and I have no regrets.
Do you feel that the Russians were spying on you, that they were targeting you, that they were, or just that they were all into the DNC? What was that like? Thinking every day you show up, you don't know. I heard a story that you walked around with a watering can sometimes, and the DNC said you were watering the bugs.
Oh, I did. It's a green watering can.
But was that real? Did you feel like they were in things?
Well, before I can, it took a while for me to really come to understand what was happening. I think initially on July 24th, when I heard Robbie Mook at around 8:15, 8:20 in the morning tell George Stephanopoulos, it's the Russians.
Yeah.
Well, previously, we were told that it was a foreign state actor back in June. As an officer, I was told in June that it was a foreign state actor, but no one gave us details. What we were told as officers of the DNC, Debbie told us, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the former chair, called. She got us on a phone call and she said, we're going to release a statement to let people know that the DNC was hacked. And we asked for more details. And at the time, the only details she could provide was that it was a foreign state actor. I didn't know exactly what was occurring until I actually became the interim chair.
But when you're chair, do you think they might be on my phone? They might be in my emails every day? What's that like? How do you go about doing your job when you're thinking that?
Well, when you get briefed by federal officials, including the number three at the FBI, and you sign a non-disclosure, you're taken to a secured room, you give up all of your quote-unquote electronics, and you are given a super secret briefing.
Mm-hmm.
I had, until I stepped down, a State Department briefing. On a State Department security clearance.
Mm-hmm.
And when I stepped into that briefing room, I showed them my State Department security badge. I thought that, oh my God, well, you know, I'm already a big deal with a security clearance. But they told me to put that away. And I said, why? I thought it was just a departmental issue. They said, no, this is at a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I knew that this was super serious. All I could tell you is that when I left that room after that briefing with a few other officers, Tom McMahon, who was my transition director, the former number three at Justice Department, Sean Henry with CrowdStrike, and Michael Sussman, a former bureau personnel, I went back to the DNC, closed the office, and stared at the ceilings. There was nothing else I could do.
And then, but you have to show up to work the next day, and you have to think like this is all going on. I mean, how does that change how you go about doing your work?
I was scared. I was scared that first day and night. I went home that night. I couldn't talk to anybody because I couldn't even tell the staff what was happening to them.
Right.
The only thing I could do.
You feel guilty about not telling the staff?
Well, I could not. I had
no,
a
I know
non-disclosure.
That you, right, of course.
No, I felt my first reaction was fear. My second reaction when I returned to work the next morning, I made a conscious decision to go back to work. Overnight, as I tried to process it by myself, I became very angry that this was happening. I became angry that it was happening to the DNC. I became angry that it was happening to the United States. And I became very angry that the world didn't know. And therefore, I had to find ways to beef myself up. And so it's funny, I called Sean Henry, because Sean Henry knew a lot more about all of these so-called, you know, I didn't know FSB, Fancy right. Bear, Cozy Bear. And I'm thinking to myself, I can now tell you Fancy Bear, Cozy Bear, FSB, because prior to, I would say, December, I didn't go out and talk about Fancy Bear or Cozy Bear, because I was told with my non-disclosure agreement, I could not share the information with anyone in the public, including the press. But Sean Henry took my call, and I said, Sean, I'm really angry now. I'm angry that this is happening. I am no longer a partisan. I'm a patriot, because I thought this was happening to my country.
How do you lead an organization when you're scared, when you're thinking that, and over the course of the next couple months, it became public, right? All the staff knew. We all started to know that there was an issue with Russia specifically. So they're knowing now what's not the extent of what you got in that briefing, but they're knowing some of what's going on. And you're angry, you're scared, you're thinking that that's going on. What do you do to the staff? How do you lead that staff to get them through what they need to get through?
Well, staff morale was already low. I had spent the better part of 2 weeks apologizing to just about anyone who would apologize. I often say, thank God I'm Catholic, because confession is part of who I am. And every week of my life, since the age of 7, I've confessed some aspect of my wrongdoings to someone. And so being a great confessor, I spent a lot of time calling up donors. I had to do four things simultaneously. Mm-hmm. One, I had to focus on the cybersecurity aspect of this. I reached out to people who knew a lot more about cybersecurity than myself. I reached out to my finance counsel, because I began to hear from more individuals that they were being harassed. Mm-hmm. So initially I heard from the staff people, and immediately I wanted the staff people to come to Philadelphia before the end of the convention. This is before my full briefing. I had a partial briefing. And because morale was still low, Seth, you know,
well, and aside from the, I mean, the Seth thing is obviously much bigger, but I mean, what I've been told by staff.
People were exploiting Seth's death on the internet.
Yep. And saying that he was killed as part of, like, because he was
part of
the
a conspiracy.
Right.
And then there were some who even tried to accuse Secretary Clinton.
Right.
So there were a lot of malicious things being said on the internet. I wanted to comfort the staff. I wanted to comfort the donors. I wanted to comfort the people who felt victimized. But I also wanted to bring the party together.
Yeah.
My focus was cybersecurity, healing the staff, healing the donors, and, you know, bringing the party together. That meant bringing in people from the Sanders campaign to come into the DNC so that I can conduct a very extensive forensic analysis of any problems or mistakes that might have occurred. And so it was, I had no time at that point to deal with my fears. I was dealing with a party that was badly maligned, a party that was broke.
Yeah,
I was dealing with staff morale, people leaving, people resigning, as well as the decision to ask certain individuals who I believed at the time showed bad judgment, and I, you know, because they're my friends, I requested that they talk to me and give me their own analysis, and many of them decided to leave rather than become a distraction.
But and then you have staff who suddenly, because their emails are out there, are getting targeted, and I think people may not understand what can happen in this situation where, I mean, I've gotten a lot of emails for just people don't like stories that I write sometimes that are nowhere near as rough of what I know is coming into
there's
a lot of
stuff.
And
people
saying, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to rape you. Yeah. I'm going to come after you.
Yeah.
Is it right?
You know, there's a difference. Look, I've been, you know, on TV, I've written columns. Right. I mean, I've had people who disagree with me. Look, after the contentious 2008 campaign in which Hillary Clinton lost to Barack Obama, although she had more votes, he had more delegates. I had people come after me. I mean, there's nothing like people who are upset and angry because their candidate didn't win, and you get vile,
right.
Nasty,
but this is different.
Malicious. That's different.
Yeah.
These are people who target you because you are an employee of the DNC.
Right.
These are people who target you because they have an objective.
And it's different because you've been through this for a while now. You're not at the beginning of your career.
I am.
You had people, you had staffers who were, hey, I didn't say anything other than you're not at the beginning of your career. You've been through a couple of battles.
Imagine being the first black woman to manage a presidential campaign and move your entire staff to Tennessee. They need me. We're going to take a break on your entire staff to Tennessee. All right, I'll be back.
So we have the last round of voting coming, but just you got some good news while...
Special election in Delaware, the 10th Senate District, Vice President Biden, Martin O'Malley, the Delaware Party. This was one of those important victories, a down ballot race, but we have learned over the last 8 years that these down ballot races, especially in state houses, matter.
Yeah.
And we feared that if we didn't invest in this race, that once again the Republicans would win another chamber. So, yay, we're happy.
And it's the last race that happens on your watch.
Oh, thank you. Well,
better to end with a win than a loss.
It's good to end with not just a victory, but also the DNC is much stronger. I walked into a party that couldn't raise money, that had enormous hemorrhage of support. Over the last 6 weeks, we've signed up more than 150,000 new members. The average contribution now is $23. We're working to help pay off all of the state party debt. We're continuing to fund our state parties every month with the SPP, the state party program. That is, we allow them, we send them a check for $7,500 for staff, for targeting. We're stronger today than ever before.
I want to take back to where you were right before we broke, which was Tennessee, picking up and moving to Tennessee.
That was, being the first black woman to manage a presidential campaign, I worked with Arnold Pinckney, who ran Jesse Jackson's campaign in 1984. That was a very interesting experience because I had to move to my native South. And of course I received, you know, the kind of bigoted statements, threats, and much, much more. But it was
just for being picked as campaign manager?
Well, you know, it's like when I started working in politics at a very, very young age.
And what's the first race?
A city council race in 1969 in my native Louisiana. And, you know, I've never been a candidate.
Yeah.
And so I've never been subjected to vitriol. But once you become a campaign manager and once you're more visible and people see you, it's unfortunate that we still have people who target you simply because of what you look like. But I can tell you, I've worked on campaigns in just about every state in this country. The vast majority of my experiences, they've been very, very positive. I enjoy politics. I enjoy public service. But, yeah, every now and then you get the kind of vitriol that is just unpleasant.
And what was going on, a lot of it comes through Twitter now or emails.
This is all before
my
ex-boss,
right?
Invented the Internet and inspired the invention of the Internet. That is correct. But no, it was just mail. It was phone calls.
At your home?
at the headquarters mainly.
Yeah. Was it scarier with the Russians this past year, or was
This was something I've never experienced in my life. In large part because it was a combination of the internet. It was suspicious packages arriving at our headquarters. We got to the point where we did not want any packages arriving that had not been X-rayed or checked. We turned back packages that, you know, this is before we had better protection as a result of the DCCC hack. We received better protection. We changed the security protocols at the DNC. We installed more security cameras. We had the building swept twice for suspicious devices plus.
You find anything?
Yes, we did report what we found. And we reported reported incidents to not just the local police, federal officials, and more.
One of the thank yous that you did in your morning farewell speech as the proceedings got started was to a person who helped you get into your house and make sure that it was safe. What's that like? Why did you feel that you weren't safe in your home? Because you were getting things at home?
I started to get things at home. Near my, you know, my property. I talked to representatives of the Metropolitan Police Department.
In Washington.
Yes, I asked them to add additional, I mean, we have a really good neighborhood association where I live, but I told them that I needed help with someone to patrol the garage area, as well as the front of my house. And when I would get home late at night, not just from working, but from traveling, sure, whatever, there was an individual who would often go up the stairs, you know, a gentleman, to make sure that there was nothing suspicious, no packages. We would take pictures of it if we did and send them on. And
so there were things that you, that spoke to you?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I followed through. More after WikiLeaks. I mean, WikiLeaks just put us all on a different type of security patrol because of the intensity of the vitriol, you know, and then some of the commentary that was being made by candidates that would lead people to believe that, you know what it's like on the internet. I mean, you've gotten some of those threats, but in my case, I got phone calls, and then I wanted to make sure that my staff was protected. So my number one priority was the DNC and to make sure that our building was safe.
When you got the call asking you to be the interim chair, if you had been told you're not going to feel safe coming home at night some nights, would you have done it?
I can't even imagine anyone would have told me. When I got the call, and later at the end of the week, when I had a chance to see Hillary as well as Bernie, I just kept squeezing her hand, like, right, yeah, I know, I got it. I've run a campaign, I've been interim chair, and so in the back of my mind, it's like 3 months.
Yeah.
You know, August, September, and October. By November, you're back, right, to work. I had no idea.
Let's talk. You ended up being the focus for Donald Trump during the campaign and others.
I thought he loved me. I really did. I really did. Look, I got a chance to meet Mr. Trump at several of the Republican forums and debates. He was charming. He always... We talked about politics. In fact,
did you think he was going to win at those debates?
As a strategist, back in August during the Iowa fair, I said on ABC, I believe at the time, that yes, I mean, you could feel the groundswell for Donald Trump. He was a different kind of candidate who was rewriting the Republican rule book. The establishment of the Republican Party thought that they could dispense of him, and I kept seeing grassroots support. And yes, I went to the DSCC, John was there, their retreat. And I spoke before John, I believe. And I think at the time, John helped me with that. I forgot. Sorry, John. I talked about how Donald Trump could be a threat in the Midwest. If John, I talked about, because Claire McCaskill was there, Tammy Baldwin was there, Bob Casey, and I kept talking, and Al Franken, and I kept saying, he is a threat. There's a possibility.
And did they say you're crazy?
No one said I was, but they looked at me. I mean, you know, we had Stan Greenberg and several other individuals on the stage, but it was my gut because I travel the country. I spend more time outside of D.C.
Yeah.
On average, I spend 4 to 5 days outside of D.C. I try to get home on Sundays, especially if I have a Sunday show, but in my past. But I kept feeling this uprising. But you couldn't look at the polls. I just felt it in my gut.
But when you talked to Trump at those forums, at those debates, you had a good rapport with him?
Yeah. I had a good rapport with all of the
Republicans. Was he different with you than... people talk often about how he can be much more engaging and charming and pulling people in than he is in public. And, you know, behind the microphone, he has his bluster and he goes to people.
There's no question that, you know, in terms of the Republican candidates, I knew Dr. Carson. I knew Rand Paul. In fact, I've had meetings with Rand Paul's on criminal justice reform. I knew Lindsey Graham. I knew Marco Rubio. I mean, you know them because you're out there on a campaign trail. You're a Democrat.
Right.
They're Republicans, but you still talk because that's politics. And Donald Trump, I got a chance to meet Don and Eric. I got a chance to meet Ivanka in large part because she was working with district officials on the hotel and she needed telephone numbers and contacts for people. I helped her.
You helped Ivanka Trump Trump hotel in
D.C.
together?
No, I did not help. No, let's not spread rumors. They were having some problems. And back in the day, I was Eleanor Holmes Norton, Chief of Staff. So I'm familiar with federal transfer of buildings through GSA to individuals. I didn't know anything about the deal. I was on a train with Ivanka, and she said that she was having trouble getting in touch with Mayor Bowser. She knew Eleanor Holmes Norton because of the...
The groundbreaking.
Thank you. Look at me. The groundbreaking. And I put in touch with somebody, Mayor Bowser. So I had a good rapport.
Uh-huh.
Good rapport, meaning that I could say hello, good morning, goodbye.
Can we just talk about what happened with the debate question, that whole issue that you got in the center of?
You know, I think there's always a lot of confusion when something is put out in a dump of emails that trickles out. So the first answer is an easy answer. Did CNN provide Donna Brazile or any other contributor debate questions? No. I've never received questions from CNN. I've made that very clear, made that very plain. I've also made it very clear that I've never received debate questions from ABC or any other source that I've ever worked with. And that much I will continue to highlight because there's no there. CNN never provided questions. When this issue arose, back on, I want to say October 11th, 12th, because I was on ABC that Sunday. And the moment I began to question the validity of the emails that were hacked and stolen from John Podesta's account, WikiLeaks began to attack my veracity.
Right.
And within a few days, WikiLeaks dumped a series of emails, and one or two of them involved me. Now, I made it clear at the time, and I continue to say that CNN never provided questions. The only other way to provide the truth is to put it in context, and the context was simple. At the time of that period, CNN, like other networks, were trying to encourage more candidate debates, but so Hillary Clinton was encouraging candidates debate. Bernie was challenging the DNC to have more debates. Martin O'Malley was challenging people. And the offices gathered to expand the number of debates. I was one of the officers who took the lead on expanding the number of debates and getting the candidates, negotiating on behalf of the candidates, to expand the debates and to work with various networks. to secure those debates. And
so you're just talking to the stakeholders. And
I mean, you know, when you have your emails dumped, the notion that as a partisan, as a strategist, that I'm not going to get involved in the process of providing not just you know, venues, sponsors, topics, questions, moderators. You know, I have spent my entire life fighting to expand the participation of not just minority candidates and others in the political process, but also the kind of questions, the kind of topics. If you go back and look at the topics, if you go back and look at the questions, those topics appear to coincide at the same time we were expanding the participation of other networks into hosting debates or forums.
So is it just that this is a joke that you were held to the journalistic standards that journalists are held to when you were a political commentator? When this is, you're not the only political commentator, you're not the only Republican or Democrat who is on TV at the same time as having clients, as having interests, that's what it seemed to me at the time, that we have a system that is kind of silly, but we and having political contributors.
Well,
with those,
you know, at the time it was just another smear campaign, right, by WikiLeaks to try to sow discord, to somehow or another suggest that I had a cache of questions that were given to one candidate over another. No, I spent most of my time during the period of that election cycle, as well as most cycles, trying to ensure that every candidate that I worked with. You know, when you're talking with Republicans, you say, look, here are my topics. What do you have to say? I don't know what goes on in Republican circles, but I do know who to call. And in the Democratic circles, not only do I talk to strategize, but I worked with all of the candidates. I worked with everyone. You know, when you look at my emails were not hacked.
Right.
My emails were not exposed. The emails that were allegedly sent from me, because some, I had spoofed emails also, but the emails that were allegedly sent to me or sent from me, told the story, but it didn't tell the complete story. But yes, I was judged at a total different standard. But let me just say this. I really enjoyed working with CNN. CNN has the utmost integrity. They are a hard group, not only a fantastic organization, they are some of the best people I know in journalism. And I've worked with them for over a decade. And as I mentioned to them at the time, I thought it was best that I stepped down so as to not get involved in what we soon learned WikiLeaks would do, a trickle of information.
But it wasn't just WikiLeaks that was coming after you. Then Donald Trump started making an issue of it.
Because it fit with the narrative. And remember, Donald Trump encouraged the Russians and others to send more, to give him more. Yeah. But it played into his narrative of that moment that he insinuated that somehow or another Hillary Clinton was corrupted and the DNC was rigged.
And even 2 weeks ago, he, at that press conference that he had, is still talking about it. Is Donald Trump obsessed with you?
You know, I don't. On the night of the election, when Hillary Clinton stepped down, I issued a statement congratulating the president-elect. You know, my inclination, whenever the election is over with, is to say, you know, may God be with you. I'm more of a patriot than a partisan when it comes to the election's over with.
But he can't stop talking about you.
No, Donald Trump has not switched off the campaign button. Mm-hmm. He is still in campaign mode. And if he wants to use his time in office, he only has 4 years, but if he wants to use 4 years, bashing Donna Brazile, insinuating misleading information, that's up to Mr. Trump. I have the respect for the office of the president, but I have no no I don't have the capacity. I have my emails, and my emails will tell you exactly what happened. My emails also indicate that I reached out to the RNC throughout the process when we were being hacked to work with us, to help us, and to join forces to take down the Russians.
Given that you had a good relationship with him, is it weird to...
Well, it's not a good relationship. I'm a Democrat. I had a good relationship with Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders.
Right, but now...
When I say good relations, I say when I would see him, sure. He was nice. Don't get me confused. I'm not his cut buddy.
Personable relationship with him. Nothing deep. But still, now he's standing at the White House talking about you.
Donald Trump and I are not friends, but I'm not his enemy. I'm not the enemy of the President of the United States. I would like to think of myself as a citizen activist who will continue to organize, continue to be an agitator, and continue in the future to lift people up and to hopefully help the next chair of the Democratic Party, Mr. Perez, recruit the next generation of Americans to serve in political office.
You're about to go sign over the documents to him and make it really official.
Yes.
You talked about what you're hoping that you'll help him do.
Yes.
When you think about, it was a bad election for the Democrats. It's a tough moment for the Democratic Party. There's a lot that needs to get done if you guys are ever going to need get back to shape. More than just advice for Tom or for people who feel disenchanted now, when you think about the tough moments that you've had in your life, and you think about tough moments as a woman, women who are really disappointed in what happened in that election, what gives you hope? What do you say to those people to say, hey, this is rough, but you've been through rough stuff?
First of all, I'm probably one of the luckiest women alive when it comes to being able to not just have a seat at the table, but how many kids who grew up in the segregated rural South could honestly wake up one morning and get an invitation to the White House to sit across from the President of the United States, who happens to be an African American. I am most proud of the work that we were able to accomplish, including the passage of the Affordable Care Act. So I'm not going to take my marbles and go home and not play again. I'm going to take time out to rest, to reflect, to possibly write, go back to teaching, and to continue to try to make a difference. I want to help recruit the next generation of Democratic activists. I think that is the most important thing that someone like myself, who I have a huge Rolodex, and just like I witnessed the election of the first African-American mayor, I ran Mary Landrieu, the former United States Senator, first statewide campaign. I worked for Geraldine Ferraro in the 1984 campaign. I was honored to be the chair of the party during a time when we nominated the first female, and now we just elected the first Latino to lead a major political party. So I'm going to continue to have hope. I'm going to continue to work for change and to help the next generation serve.
And the people who feel depressed and still dejected?
Well, you know, I'm tired. I'm not depressed. I'm tired. I mean, I was tired after we lost one state by 537 votes. So you can imagine three states by about 78,170 votes when Donald Trump cracked the blue wall. But my grandmother, when we were kids growing up, she would call us in honor of our birth. Cheryl, Sheila, Donna, Tatey, Chet, Lisa, Dimitri, Kevin, Zilla. Did I tell you we were Catholic? And my grandmother would give us a prayer. And I'll never forget the scripture that she often quoted from the book of Galatians, chapter 6, verse 9. Do not grow weary in doing good, for in due season you'll reap a harvest if you don't give up. For members of my generation, we're still planting seeds and we're still harvesting. And so my job is I still have a lot of work to do, and my job is not done yet.
All right, Donna Brazil, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Where's the Russian vodka, Joe?